The Vietnam War, it's over. Your job's just begun.
A new HBO original limited series.
Welcome to the world of spycraft. Strap in.
From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr.
What are you concealing?
Based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Viet Thanh Nguyen.
What if I told you that I was a communist spy?
How did you become this?
The Sympathizer, streaming April 14th on Max. Subscription required.
This podcast contains information, theories, and speculation based on the A Song of Ice and Fire novels by George R.R. Martin. It can and will spoil future episodes of the HBO television series Game of Thrones. This is your one and only spoiler warning. If you're looking for our non-spoiler podcast on Game of Thrones, please look in our feed archives for our Sunday night instant take and Tuesday afternoon full podcasts, or go to baldmove.com for our entire catalog. Hey guys and gals, welcome back to the spoiler edition of the Game of Thrones podcast. We're a podcast now.
You know, you got me on it now, so the bods are in full effect.
That's right. We decided since the books have caught up, or the show has caught up to the books, we're just going to turn this into a fitness podcast and talk about how you can maximize your Game of Thrones bod.
The Westerosi Fitness Program.
Going to be interviewing the mountain that rides. Gregor Clegane, see what his how many eggs a day he eats, all that kind of stuff. No,
and Tim Ferriss, of course.
Sure. No, this is the spoiler version of the Game of Thrones podcast, and I'm starting to realize as I was preparing for the last day or two that this is going to having a second person on here is going to be interesting, especially a person that we are going to be slowly breaking into the spoiler side of Game of Thrones. Because I've realized that there's only a certain amount of topics that I can broach that you are probably going to retain.
Sure.
But I think that's important because I think there's going to be a lot of the more adventuresome show watchers now that they've heard that, you know, everything is getting caught up, that they're going to give in to temptation and taste the forbidden fruits. So they're going to be in the same spot as you. So I feel like a little bit of this explanation of background stuff is going to be great. But... You know, before I was entirely scripting, you know, essentially my thoughts, and I had them all mapped out, and I had all my research at my fingertips. And this time, I'm probably, you know, you're going to ask me questions that I'm going to give off the top of my head, because that's
right.
One of the secret sauces for our podcast is we don't script any of this stuff. We come with a couple bullet points. And all the conversation is kind of organically based on, we don't talk about it beforehand.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is going to be something where it's not going to be like the stuff that the show has just talked about this week. It might be something I read 3 years ago, you asked me. And so sure. I might get a few things wrong, a few details wrong. As always, I'm happy to make corrections and get things straight. But just want to set everyone's expectations. Mm-hmm. You know, so far has been a kind of a book reader only joint. And, you know, now that we're kind of doing a blended thing, I just want to make sure everybody knows that there might be some getting off into the weeds, and like I won't anticipate where some of these conversations go. Also, if you sent me questions, I've opened up yet another document where it's like, okay, this isn't time sensitive and this is going to blow Jim's brains. So I'm going to put this in a document and sling it in it later on to bring it up. You know, when we don't have so many topics to introduce. So,
hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's kazoo concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's bachelorette bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Got your happy Priceline.
Want to talk about that. And also, I was just thinking about my reaction to this show, and I guess Jim's reaction versus a lot of the people on, especially the more book purist side of the internet. And I guess I kind of came to the realization that we assume good faith on the part of the Double Ds, David sure. Benioff and Dan Weiss, where I think that a lot of book readers, when they see changes, they assume that there's incompetence or meddling or, you know, they're taking creative license. Until I see concrete evidence elsewise, I'm going to assume that they're trying their best to film Game of Thrones straight up. And they have to right. take shortcuts. They probably don't like to take shortcuts. And they're on a tight filming schedule. And they have those limitations to work with. And also, they do other stupid stuff because, you know, they're at various, you know, levels of informed and ignorant and clued in about different things. But I do think that they have their heart in the right place. So, and again, until I see some real egregious stuff. That's where I'm going to be rolling.
What about Dorne? Can I ask you about Dorne? Like, well, how do you feel? Because
that's the thing. I was about to transition into my book because I kind of kept a little of this on a wraps on the main podcast. The things I didn't like about Dorne, Aerio Hota, who is the big bodyguard who had the fancy axe.
Got stabbed in the back.
He's kind of a badass in the books, and I was expecting some badass stuff. Like, I don't mind him dying, but the fact that he just died from a dirk,
mm-hmm.
I thought that would have been a great opportunity to show some real sand snake mojo, you know, to have maybe a 3-on-1 where they take him down or a 2-on-1 where they take him down. The fact that they were just kind of disposed of did in the same way that I felt a twinge of sorrow for Barristan Selmy going down, even though that was kind of badass. I know that he does a lot more interesting things in the book, and it hurt. It stung a little.
Okay.
But I'm assuming that the plot line of Dorne eventually going to war with the Crownlands, with King's Landing, is going to happen in the book. I don't think that is just a curveball. I think that's and the Double D's are sitting here and looking, geez, how can we do this? Okay, we're going to go this way. Lots more to talk about on that, because I think that we had some people chiming in with some really good thoughts.
Well, my question was more along the lines of, like, you know, this good faith idea with the Double D's. It's my understanding that the Dorne stuff has been some of the most significant deviations from the book.
Sure. It's a real Kirkman-style remix, honestly.
Right. And also, it's been some of the weakest stuff in the show, I think. But, kind of by far.
Yes.
Like, I mean, consistent, more consistently bad.
Yes.
Or more consistently weak than the rest of the show. So, how do you feel about that? Like, knowing that they're going off script and the stuff they've done that's most off script is also the weakest?
Well, again, that's the assumption of the good faith. I'm guessing that they know where the plot is going from George's perspective.
Right.
And they're aiming towards that, so it's not immediately obvious. Like, I guess my big question is, why have Doran at all? Why have Prince Doran?
Is he king?
Yeah, he was a prince. They don't have, he's not.
They don't have kings in Doran?
Well, there's only one king in Westeros.
But
it's interesting. So Dorne's got this interesting history where they're the lone kingdom that wasn't outright conquered by.
So he used to be king?
No, they were all, I guess it was a principality.
Oh, okay.
So, but they're the one that they continue styling their leader as, a prince, as kind of, that's their whole unbent, unbowed, unbroken thing.
Uh-huh.
I don't know that anybody else in the kingdom would get away with doing that, but they weren't conquered. They got married in and kind of a peace made. So they're kind of allowed that little grace.
I think the main problems there, and this is kind of all over Reddit, it's what made me start really thinking about it, is the motivations aren't great there. Like, we hear a lot of words coming out of Alaria's mouth this episode, but we don't see a lot of that. We don't feel a lot of that, right? Yeah. Like, the people hate you. They think you're a traitor. Like, they think you're weak and a coward and aren't defending the crown like you should be. Or not the crown, but, our kingdom.
Mm-hmm. The dignity and integrity and honor of it.
Right. We don't see any of that. Like, we've never seen that.
But how would you show a leader who's isolated from his people's opinion?
Well, I'm not a writer. I'm not a writer.
I know, but would you show, riots right outside his gates and he just can't hear him?
They did it pretty well with Daenerys, right? I mean, a lot of the decisions she's made, she was making led up to kind of a revolt of all the people.
But that was based on a lot of cultural misunderstanding, like her coming and doing one thing and thinking she'd get this reaction, whereas Prince Doran, I don't know. And the other thing is, in Prince, like, there's a lot
It's just a problem that we haven't seen it, and all we get is the exposition, and it feels super flimsy because of that.
You're right.
And that's part of what makes it feel bad, and to me, that's the fault of the writing. Like, you can know where the plot goes and work toward getting there, but that's kind of where the writing falls down in those scenes.
Yeah, but so the thing that's cool about Doran, let's suspense with Prince Doran for a minute, because we're going to get to him. But the whole idea I keep coming back to is, because really Doran going to war with King's Landing is not that interesting. That's just yet another potentially unspoilt kingdom for the Winter War that's going to be thrown into this useless blender.
Right.
So that's just kind of par for the course. The really interesting things are the Sand Snakes are dispatched throughout the kingdom to do various tasks. And one of the interesting things, which I talked about in a few podcasts, because it's kind of it's kind of very low-key, the fact that he introduces this at the very end of Dance with Dragons. But one of the Sand Snakes has been sent to the Citadel. And she's posing as a boy that's like an acolyte. And you know, there's something significant about them being there. And I feel like that is a very critical part of the plot in a way that Doran isn't. But how do you introduce those characters? And also, Prince Oberyn is so awesome that, you know, there's this kingdom of Doran. It's almost like, oh, man, how can you get to the Sand Snakes plot and have the readers not go like, what the hell happened to Doran? They kill one of their princes and everything's cool. I get it's tribal combat and all that kind of thing. That's one of the things people are so pissed at, like, you know, why is Alaria so mad? Like, this is kind of what Oberyn wanted.
Yeah.
He didn't want this, but...
But he chose it. He was trying to get his revenge. Yes. They got the best of him.
It's all legal.
Yeah.
But that's the other thing.
And it's all fair, too. It's not like they were...
But that's the thing about medieval politics. Like, everyone talks about the rules when it serves them, but when they don't like the rules and they have the might behind it, then fuck the rules. I'm going to get what I want. I'm going to do a rebellion. So... I have to think that they had to connect the dots between Prince Oberyn, because you cannot tell the story without the Mountain and the Viper. Holy shit.
Okay,
And then they need the Sand Snakes for whatever Sand Snake espionage crazy stuff they're going to get up to later.
Yeah.
So they needed a way to connect those dots. It's unfortunate they couldn't give Doran a little bit, give him a little bit more of, because in the book he's kind of... you know, this cuddly teddy bear kind of guy. He actually said between, you know, the Oberyn is the viper that's baring his fangs at you. I'm the snake in the grass.
Okay.
Everyone thinks he's weak and ineffectual and just taking this, but he's actually got these really long-term plans to fuck the Lannisters.
Gotcha.
It's hard for me to believe that they couldn't get a little bit of that in there, but then... You know, if that could be 20 extra minutes in a season that's already full to bursting.
Sure.
On the other hand, this is a short episode. I get why people are upset. And
I think, if anything, they maybe should have postponed it a little bit longer, right? I mean, we don't have the book yet. It's not like they are on a super crucial timeline here.
Well, but Sam's got to go to the Citadel.
Right.
I mean, they are kind of on a timeline.
How long will Sam be at the Citadel? I honestly don't know. Like,
I don't either.
You don't either?
He just arrives at the end of... I mean, like I said, that's one of the things where the books are kind of right there with the show currently.
So I guess I don't know what kind of timeline they're on, but it feels like...
It's one of those things where,
they kind of pushed it a little too fast for me.
But it's two ships passing the night, and the ships can slow down, but eventually they can't stop.
Uh-huh.
So I don't know. I think Doran's not... That's the thing. I don't think Doran's the most exciting thing to show, and there's a lot of bad things about it, but there's also... Mm-hmm. It's not the most exciting thing in the book. I suspect a lot of that stuff is red herring anyway, and there's also some dumb stuff in the book. So I think that, again, it'll be interesting to see... I'm very interested to see, years from now, when these books come out, how we as fans synthesize these two materials and whether there'll be a kind of this reconciliation where it's like, well, I guess the double D's weren't as bad as we thought. Mm-hmm. Or if it'll be even worse, that like, oh my God, this thing that George came up with was so fucking elegant and the show is such a pale imitation that I don't know which way it goes. But again, assume good faith. I'm assuming that that they're steering the ship by the true North Star.
Okay.
The other thing I want to talk about is kind of how old Melisandre is.
All right.
Because the actress, Van Houten, mentioned in an interview that she was told that she was 400 years old.
Huh.
And there's not a shred of evidence for that, her being ancient. There is that, you know, Melisandre being old and glamoring herself to look like a young person has been theorized based on a few, like, you know, the ruby necklace is a big thing because, so in the books, she burns Mance Rayder alive, just like she does in the show. But in the books, what you didn't see is that she actually put some kind of ruby bracelet on Rattleshirt, the Lord of Bones, the guy that had the big skull on his head.
Okay.
And glamored him to look like Mance Rayder. And they burned him instead. Then they used Mance Rayder for something else, which I'm not going to get into right now because your mind will be blown.
Okay.
But because of that and the fact that she's got this flashing red ruby thing around her neck, it's like, oh, maybe she's glamming herself. And in some of her few POV chapters at the end of Dance of Dragons, she has visions and dreams and recollections of her being a slave girl and being sold for various reasons because of some physical similarities from other characters like the three-eyed raven and one of his old lovers. Some people have speculated that she is actually the daughter of the three-eyed raven. That's the old man who's up in the
tree.
Trees.
Yeah. Sure.
So this has kind of been a popular thought. And the other thing that's cool is, like, if she's from 100 years ago, she could be related to the blood raven, the three-eyed crow. But if she's 400 years old, the exciting thing about that is that she could have been around to see the doom of Valyria. And that's, the thing that destroyed the continent that that all the Targaryens came from and then conquered Westeros. And there's some mysteries around that, even in the universe, and it's kind of like this thing that no one knows a lot about. And she could shed some light on that. So there's not a lot of hard evidence about what her age is, but those are kind of the prevailing theories.
Okay.
The final thing I want to talk about before we get the feedback is the burning of the ships. What the fuck? Because that was one of the reasons I kind of hung my hat on the fact that, you know, we're going to talk about this Greyjoy plot the Kraken and all this stuff. But what I don't get is one of the reasons I thought that they're not going to do the Kingsmoot plot, they're not going to do the Greyjoy plot and introduce all these new characters is because Dany was gifted 100 ships because of Dario's, you know, daring do.
Uh-huh.
And why the hell would you give her enough ships? One of the main things that everyone's excited about the Greyjoys coming to ally with Dany is that they are a sea power. And we're assuming that Dany's going to have a Khalasar, Dany's going to have all these Unsullied, Dany's going to have a couple badass knights with her, and that. What? But how is she going to get across the sea? Well, boom, you've got the premier seafaring the kingdom in Westeros coming to gift you their fleet of ships.
All right.
And a marriage, some kind of marriage alliance.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, they've introduced 100 ships, so we don't need that. I don't understand why they did that and then immediately burnt it. It seems like it's just a way to keep the show fans engaged. Like, next season she'll get to Westeros, we promise. Like, here's the 100 ships. And the way the books where it's like, oh, I get it. The Greyjoys are going over. Victarion's coming over with his big fleet. Ah, that's going to be how... There was nothing for that on the show because they weren't getting to that whole plot line. So if you just went a whole season without addressing the fact that she's trying to get to Westeros at all, people would get impatient. I don't know. That's the one thing that I don't get.
Now
it seems entirely redundant.
It does, yeah. Can I ask you, do we know for a fact, do you know as a book reader, that Daenerys is ever going to get to Westeros? Has she gotten to Westeros yet?
Okay. In fact, she's out fucking around with Drogon, just like she is. That's where we end. In fact, yeah.
When you say, you know, a breadcrumb for readers to say, hey, she's going to go to Westeros this season, you're entirely speculating. Like, there's nothing to say she's actually going to end up.
No,
going
I'm not.
To Westeros.
I mean, it is speculation.
Okay.
However, you know, we only have from this point forward, roughly two seasons, a little bit more than two seasons left. So if she doesn't get to Westeros, what the hell?
But you're you're assuming she needs to go to Westeros. Like, she could be killed. She could, whatever. Like, there's a lot of stuff that could happen. Maybe I just don't know the other theories that are out there and the other information.
No, it's a literary theory. It's a meta theory that, like, at some point, you can't just keep killing off people that you've spent five books with as POV. Like, what the hell is the point?
Okay. Like, yes, I just want, like, you're stating it as fact, and I'm coming into this going,
you're entirely right.
Okay.
You're entirely right. But there's a fine line there, because, like, yeah, you kill off Rob in book three.
Uh-huh.
And there's still significant, like, deaths and things that happen and shocking things to come, but, like, eventually, if you kill off Jon, and you kill off Arya, and you kill off, Dany, like, what the hell is the point?
Sure.
Are you going to introduce an entirely new cast? You know, it's like you completely recast the entire book series, and these are the actual heroes, and George is just fucking with us for five books?
Right.
Like, at some point, it's like, yeah, maybe one or two more, but good Christ. So that's kind of my thoughts going into the feedback about how I thought about the episode. Hey, want to make a quick pitch for our premium club.baldmove.com feeds and features. If you go to club.baldmove.com, you can sign up for as little as $1 a month. And a primary benefit for you, you're going to skip all the future ads because we got ad-free feeds. We also got a lot of cool bonus features for you Game of Thrones fans. Not only do we live record our main podcast and Instant Take, that's the best, fastest way you can get it. We start recording like 10 after, 5 after, and everybody else has to wait longer for us to record it and edit it and publish it, all that stuff. So you get it immediate. The other benefit is we get extra features, such as we're doing a playthrough of the final chapter of Telltale's Game of Thrones video game, where we ineptly pilot various houses of Westeros against each other. And we try to take the path less taken. Like, if you're the average gamer and you're going to do A, we try to zig and go and do B with sometimes hilarious results. Also, we did a spoiler reaction thing where I showed Jim three of the most popular fan theory videos on Alt-Shift-X, and then we recorded his reaction to it, and we had a little kind of mini debate and discussion that might be interesting. And we have one other surprise we're going to start working on this week. It might take us a couple weeks to get it together, but it especially if you're a big board gamer, might be something you're interested in. But it's going to be a happening season. It's a great way to support us, too, because the only way we can do one podcast, much less three a week, is because we do this on a full-time basis. So go to club.baldmove.com if that sounds like something you'd be interested in and you'd like to help us out, and we'd certainly appreciate it. Let's start with G from Pasadena. This is super interesting. So there's a site called MakingGameOfThrones.com, which is a official site from HBO, and they catalog like the behind-the-scenes making of Game of Thrones. And this week, they showed some high-res shots of the different props that they used. And one of the props was the letter that Prince Doran gets.
Yeah, I saw this.
From King's Landing. And you can actually read what the letter said, and this kind of talks to the plot hole we talked about as far as, you know, how did Prince Tristan get murdered, and how did the Sand Snakes get there, and what was Tristan doing on that boat. The letter reads as follows. The Princess Myrcella died by poison on our return journey. This is written by Jaime Lannister.
Yeah.
I suspect Alaria, not you, but my sister will demand war. I doubt Alaria's head will appease her, but it is a start along with your nieces. Your son cannot stay in King's Landing. I am sending him back on the same ship. Now this resolves the plot hole of like what ship was he on and how did they get there and why wasn't he being guarded, and etc.
Right.
Apparently he was on, like, even though they showed him clearly in King's Landing's harbor, and he was painting eyes, that he was on his way back, that Jaime
probably
was going
to send
him
around
back
to, you know, mourn the loss of Myrcella.
Right.
For a day or two, and then head back.
But that, to me, this raises a lot of questions in my mind. Like, why does Jaime have the authority to do this? Is this something he's assuming? Like, this should be the king and the small council's decision. And that's
I'm not sure they know that he's doing this. Like,
no, I know.
Because he's sending Tristan back, you know, to keep him from Cersei and being used as a pawn and all this stuff. And like,
but when he says that speech to Cersei about fuck everybody,
right,
we're going to take from everything and blah, blah, blah. If he was already in that mindset, why would you trade away your best political chip? Like, even if you don't suspect Doran, the way to keep him compliant with your demands, like you need to murder you need to murder Alaria, you need to murder your nieces, you know, keeping his son as hostage is a good way to do that.
Maybe he was thinking it's better to have this good faith gesture. I don't know.
That doesn't seem very Games of Thrones-ish.
Right. I'm with you.
And also it shows that, you know, Jaime's capable of freelancing to a degree that I found a little bit shocking. And also we know that he's right to not suspect Thorin, but yeah. I don't know a reasonable person, a cautious person, which again, Jaime Lannister really isn't any of those things. It makes Jaime seem a little bit as foolish as his sister, which might be a point.
Yeah. I mean, the way that Dorin just let them go, you know, he wasn't there to, he didn't take advantage of the situation they had him in. They had Jaime in.
Yeah.
So maybe he was assuming that he would do the same for Dorin.
But if this was Doran's plot, that's exactly what he'd do. Yeah. Go ahead. Oh, and we poisoned your.
Of course. Yeah.
So I. But yeah, then again, why would he let.
Less than cautious.
The fact that he let his son, like, I mean, that's pretty cold blooded to put your son in that kind of harm's way.
Right.
So I guess that's a good indicator. But I thought it was interesting that. And I don't know, again, why we couldn't get a minute or two to establish that stuff going on. Because if we didn't have this scroll on this making of site, none of this discussion would even be possible.
Yeah.
And that's the other thing. What's your opinion on this kind of stuff? Like, if it's a production detail that didn't make it into the show that you couldn't even read or see, is that canon?
I think so.
Is it canon unless it's directly contradicted? Because obviously if... You know,
yeah, I think that's reasonable.
If Jaime throws him in prison in the screen, but the prop says that he let him go, then we got to go with what's on screen.
Right.
But in absolute, you're saying if there's no conflict, we should accept these production details as...
Yeah, I mean, if that's what the actor was looking at, and that's the canon that's in the actor's head, I think that's probably a good start, a good indicator.
Okay.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
House of the Dragon Season 2 is coming up sooner than you think. And to get us all back in that Leal state of mind, Aaron and I have teamed up with Maester Anthony to bring you coordinated coverage, new and old. For the next 10 weeks leading up to Season 2, Maester Anthony will be releasing an episode of his Season 1 coverage on the Hot D podcast. He originally recorded and released it exclusively on his Double Dragon podcast, so while it's retro coverage, it's almost certainly new to you.
In addition, each Friday, Jim and I will be reading the relevant sections of George Martin's Targaryen history book, Fire and Blood, so that we can compare and contrast it to that week's episode of Hot D Season 1. So grab a copy of Fire and Blood and read along with us if you're so inclined. Just don't read ahead, unless you enjoy spoilers.
If that's not enough to satisfy your craving for fantasy entertainment, well, you're in luck. We recently watched King Arthur, Legend of the Sword, which is Guy Ritchie's uniquely stylish and anachronistic riff on the King Arthur legend. Yes, Guy Ritchie took on the most famous of all English legends and did it with huge ambitions. Sadly, or perhaps thankfully, depending on your tastes, his ambitions were cut short by meager audience interest. Join us for the podcast this Tuesday as we discuss why that might have been and whether this retelling is any good.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
FX is adapting James Clavell's best-selling novel, Shogun, into a 10-part miniseries this spring. Set in the shogunate period of Japan at the turn of the 15th century, Shogun depicts the rise of a feudal lord to Shogun, as seen through the eyes of a shipwrecked English sailor. It's loosely based on the real-life exploits of William Adams and Tokugawa Ieyasu.
Shogun has already been successfully adapted back in 1980 with a widely acclaimed miniseries starring Richard Chamberlain, featuring intricate plots, political scheming, complex characters, and thrilling action. This time, husband and wife team Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo try to recapture the successes of the novel and early adaptations while increasing the levels of historical and cultural accuracy that are often perceived as flaws of this and similar works.
Starring Hiroyuki Sanada from The Last Samurai, Mortal Kombat, and John Wick 4, with Cosmo Jarvis of Peaky Blinders, Raised by Wolves, etc., joining the truly massive cast required to bring this complex world to life. Join Aaron and I each week as we deep dive into each episode, uncovering the mysteries, the intrigue, and the glory of Shogun.
Shogun premieres on FX Hulu Tuesday, February 27th, with a two-part debut. Our podcast will release each Thursday thereafter. Get our Shogun coverage by searching for Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
Michael K. This is going to be another rabbit hole probably to go down.
Oh, boy.
I found it interesting how Danny threw out the line, "Till the sun rises in the west," again. Given that Tristane is dead, this seems odd. Who else might be the sun from the west? If it obviously was re-mentioned for the purpose, do you have any thoughts? Okay. So, review slash refresher time and slash information time for Jim.
Mm-hmm.
If you'll recall, when the Magi woman, I think her name is Miri Mundur. It's the slave woman that Danny rescued from being raped from the Dothraki, the one that did some black magic with Drogo to try to save his life. Turned him into a vegetable.
I vaguely remember her.
And she ended up getting burnt to death from revenge by Danny. When, you know, she had done all this stuff and stabilized Drogo and he's a vegetable, Danny's like, you know, when is he going to come back? And she said, when the sun rises in the west and sets in the east, when the seas go dry and the mountains blow like the wind, or blow in the wind like leaves, when your womb quickens again and you bear a living child, then he will return and not before.
Is it? Aren't they just saying never? Fucking never.
That is the plain reading of the situation is she's right. Saying, never.
Yeah.
This is what you get.
Saying
nah,
good luck with that.
That's right. And that's what everyone thought until Dance with Dragons.
Oh, boy.
Because, so we talked about this Dorne plot.
Mm-hmm.
Prince Doran had this long-standing agreement with Illyrio, who was the person who took in Viserys and Dany, the brother and sister, that he was going to marry his daughter to Viserys, and then Dorne was going to support the Targaryens' return to power once they came of age.
Okay.
And that was his long revenge plan. He's going to kick out the Baratheon usurpers and the Lannister usurpers and have his revenge, and he gives this big, you know, this shocking reveal where he's like, yes, this is my plan all along, and you guys are just too stupid to see it. So he sends his son, in the book it's his son Quentin, across the Narrow Sea undercover to go make this, you know, give this proposal to Danny because he's got the sealed document and everything. Now, of course, the plans change somewhat because it's no longer his daughter to Viserion, it's his son to Danny. He goes to propose to her, and a lot of people realized, you know, the sigil for the House Martell, who rules Dorne, is the sun spear. It's literally a flaming sun
right.
with a spear. And people notice it's interesting that the sun literally did sail from west to east to fulfill that part of this quote-unquote prophecy.
Okay.
Just by landing there.
Mm-hmm.
When the seas go dry, Dany at the end of Dance with Dragons, she's in the Dothraki, what they call the Dothraki Sea, which is this
right.
big grassy
yeah.
area. And it has started to turn brown and wither because of the, I can't remember if it was the climate or if it's a seasonal thing. So the seas are starting to go dry.
And if she's going to take all these Dothraki with her as an army, couldn't that also be a figurative seas going dry?
Yeah, you're right.
Taking the people out of the land?
That could be. And the mountains blow in the wind like leaves, that could be an allusion to the Gregor Clegane being killed. Your womb quickens again because she does one of the curses that she put on her that she couldn't have children anymore. At the end of Dance with Dragons, Dany's bleeding, either from a period or some people speculate that she's having a miscarriage. So it's like people are like, well, holy fuck, this is something that happened in book one. There's a lot of poetic ways you can interpret these prophecies coming true.
Right.
And if so, what the hell does that mean? You know?
Good question.
Okay. So that the fact that she mentions it again and the fact that we're kind of in this point of the books as well could be an indication that these theories that prophecy had some things to it. It wasn't just a cold-blooded way to say never.
Right.
That could be coming around.
Okay. I'm on board with that.
And
sounds good.
There's a lot of other ways that could. But the thing is, here's the problem.
Oh, no.
That part of the Dorne plot got completely wrapped up.
It did, yeah.
So how is the sun going to rise from the west and go to the east? Is that going to be some kind of sand snake mission? I don't know.
So you don't have any... I know you said this in the full cast, but maybe you couldn't get into it because it was spoilery. You don't have any indication of who's going to take over leadership at Dorne in the city
there?
It
seems like it's going to be Ilaria, although there's, you know, feedback that's like that's kind of tough to swallow, that a bastard...
Right, yeah.
You know, and I think I did mention that, so no,
a bastard lover of a prince, like...
Yeah.
You made that point, like she's not married
to
Oberyn.
And she's not a lady.
Right.
Which, you know, she's not of any kind of noble lineage. Yeah. So
I'm just wondering, like, how dead his plots are. Will someone come in and get the presidential talk? Like, look, here's all this shit that's been going down. You need to get on board and forget your campaign promises. Cause...
Now, Dorne does have a tradition of having ruling women, though. And
okay.
And so that's a little bit, I don't know if they're going to put Ilaria on the throne or what, or if there's going to have some kind of legitimized daughter. I don't know. I really have no idea. But
what about her? The Sand Snakes are her daughters, right? And Oberyn's daughters?
Yes.
What about one of them?
Right. Well, you still got the problem that they're bastard daughters of a bastard daughter.
But of a rightful heir, the son.
So who would legitimize them?
I don't.
Because that's the thing. Like, Doran could have, Oberyn could have, but I don't know that Ilaria can. Because she doesn't, like, she'd have to be legitimized and have then some kind of authority to legitimize them.
Hmm. Yeah.
I don't know. And that's the other thing is, like, does the average show watcher know this much about the bastardry and how all this stuff works?
Probably not exactly, but they probably have a general feel, given what we know about Jon and Ramsay. And...
But that's a big question, whether the Double Ds are like, we're going to do this and hope no one notices and no one asks any questions. Because, again, we're just trying. The way this thing is kind of slipshod, I just don't feel like they feel as passionate about Dorne as they do about some of the other stuff. And maybe they're just trying to hastily get to the good part. Like, oh, Oberyn is awesome. This middle part's kind of, but Endgame's awesome, too.
But yeah, I guess Danny's, you know, involvement there is kind of cut short. So, like, all of those master plans have just been, just had their heart stabbed.
Well, that's the other thing. That's the other crazy thing. In the books, Quentin, he goes there. Danny rejects him because she's already married the Myrinese guy.
Uh-huh.
And then he goes and decides when to go try to tame the dragons himself when she goes missing. Like, I need to be bold. And kind of Tyrion puts the bug up his ass that, you know, you're cousin niece or cousin aunt is not going to respect a boy coming to her and being passive. So he decides to go down there and try to tame the dragons, and he gets roasted alive.
So where's this Quentin guy in the show?
He
doesn't exist?
Well, so Quentin is the older brother of Tristan.
Right.
Tristan. We all thought that maybe this was where Tristan was going to go until he got sold as a hostage. Uh-huh. Now I have no idea.
We don't know where he is in the show. Like, has he been mentioned?
No,
he doesn't exist.
Nuh-uh.
Oh wow.
So
okay.
Now maybe I wonder if there's going to, because we know there's some flashbacks coming back to the Tower of Joy. I wonder if there'll be a corresponding flashback to a young Prince Doran making a deal with Illyrio, who they've already established in the show, where they say that, hey, we're going to make the secret of marriage alliance, and turns out that Illyrio's had Quentin this whole time, and no one's known it.
So Quentin could conceivably come back and sit on the Dornish.
I don't know whether showrunners would accept that and how many flashbacks they can get away with.
Right.
I mean, I don't know.
It almost feels a little retconny in some ways.
Yeah. So we're going to get more into the Greyjoy thing here, Isaac R's email. Okay. In the spirit of Martin's Razor, are you familiar with that? Because
I don't think so.
That's my idea of that. If you've got a bunch of characters with kind of similar geography and motivations and character traits, that the Double Ds tend to combine them to make narrative simplicity.
Right.
So in spirit of Martin's Razor, I have a theory about Dany and her need for ships. I know that casting news suggests that Euron and Victarion Greyjoy are going to make appearances this season, but I predict that it is Theon who sails to Meereen with a fleet at his back. This way, Theon, who is in the show, has a lot of time invested in, can continue to have some major involvement in a prominent plotline. It can be a way for Theon to prove himself to his uncles, who probably would want to give him some kind of test before trusting him. Hopefully by the end of the season, Dany is sailing west with Greyjoy ships full of Unsullied and Dothraki. Thoughts?
All right.
So
I don't know anything about these other guys, but I know I like Theon.
Yeah, so there's this plot in the books, which has not come to pass in the show, where Theon's father gets murdered. Assassinated.
Okay.
And the way that the Iron Islanders select their king is there's definitely blood counts for something, but they have this thing called a king's moot.
Right, you told me about this.
Where all of the, it's kind of like a political convention where all the guys come together and gals in this case, because Yara throws her hat in the ring. They give a speech about why they all get together. They all gather together and they give a speech about why I should be made king or queen. And then they pour a bunch of tribute, and that's an important part because they're all, essentially all pirates. So they have these big treasure chests, and they spill it in front of everybody. Like, this is what you get for voting me. I mean, money in politics is just straight up how much cash you got.
Okay.
And everyone has, like, a bigger and bigger chest. So Victarion is this, like, he's probably the most respected fighter. He's, like, their best sea captain. He's their best battle strategist. He's their best military leader. He's a physically imposing specimen that can, like, kill guys with his bare hands. And he has got this really stormy relationship with his brother Euron, who's more of a like a Jack Sparrow type of pirate. Not in that he's silly, but he's more of a, you know, like a conniving, scheming. People say he has magical powers, and he's got this weird eye that can foresee the future and all this other stuff.
he kills people with his squid hands.
But he's also been away from the Iron Islands for a long time because he got he's sailing over on the Undying Lands over in Old Valyria, where the Doom of Valyria is, and he comes back as a surprise at the King's Moot, and he has this dragon. He has this horn that he says he found in Old Valyria
can
control dragons.
Okay,
and he also has the most treasure of anyone, and he gets made king.
Winner. Boom.
Yep.
Yeah.
And he decides to give Victarion the task of taking the fleet, the Greyjoy's fleet, over to Dany and proposing a marriage alliance between himself and Dany, and giving her these ships and then telling her about the horn. And then he says, he's essentially going to make the Iron Islands great again, because Iron Islands have been kind of a vassal kingdom for a long time, and none of them like it because they're all a bunch of pirates. So he's saying, Isaac here, is that Theon's going to be the one that sails the Meereen. I don't know, because, yes, that kind of seems awesome for him to do, but then what are they doing to Victarion? And also, how, like, Theon seems like his fate is bound to Sansa and Brienne.
At this point, sure.
How are they going to shuffle him off to the Iron Islands, get
he'd
into
have
the
to
King's
meet up with Yeah, he'd have to meet up with a lot of people that we haven't seen either in a very long time or at all. It might be difficult.
Yeah, so that's the big problem, is like you're already duplicating a role that someone else has. And if Victarion hadn't been cast, I would suggest that I'd be more open to the idea.
He's been cast?
Yeah.
Oh, well, shit.
Yeah. That's like, I just don't see it happening.
Right, I would have applied the razor and just said, yeah, they'll dispense with Victarion. But
no, hopefully by the end of the season, she is indeed sailing west. That would be an awesome, like, you know, ending awesome montage that they do. And there's a lot more about the Victarion stuff. It gets kind of crazy.
Okay.
But not right. Viv W. says, in the books, when Cersei is given her future reading by Maggie the Frog, Maggie told Cersei that she would be killed by a Valonqar, which means little brother in High Valyrian. I feel as though Arya will be the one to take down Cersei using Tyrion's face, which would fulfill the little brother prophecy. I'm not sure if anyone has suggested this theory yet, but I'd be interested in seeing what you guys thought of it. So, Jim, just so you know, other than the whole three children of gold and that you'll have and three shrouds they'll bear and all that stuff, there is something in the books where she prophesies that this Valonqar, which is a word meaning little brother, is going to murder you. Now, Cersei in the books, and they kind of got this a little bit in the show, suspects Tyrion because she's always thinking Tyrion's out to get the family.
Yeah.
And for good reason. I think Tyrion legitimately is out to get the family at this point.
Yep.
There's been a couple other surprise suggestions, like, for example, Sandor Clegane, the Hound, is a little brother. And if he's still alive with the whole gravedigger theory, maybe he could somehow. That would be a twist. Another twist is Jaime himself, I believe, was born after, even though they're twins, he was the second one born. So he's also technically her little brother.
Okay.
And there are a lot of good plot-based reasons why he might find, you know, just get fed up with her and strangle her to death before everything's said and done.
Uh-huh.
What do you think of this Arya taking over Tyrion's face, which would imply Tyrion's dead, that this would be, like, kind of backdoor fulfilling the prophecy? I don't know if I like it.
I don't know. It might be interesting. To get somebody's face, do they have to put them through this process?
As far as I know, the Hall of Faces can only be taken over if they're dead. Now,
dead and processed, or just plain like dead? Anyway,
no. Like, there's she take John's face? There's a whole like, that's what they were doing in those corpses.
Right, I thought
heavily
so.
Implied that's what they're doing in those corpses.
And spoiler alert, in one of the upcoming episode like previews, I saw we see Jack and Hagar taking someone's face off, like literally peeling the face off of someone in that room, and I presume putting it in the Hall of Faces,
right. And there's like a big long ritual about how they get the face to adhere. So
all right,
yeah,
it's not just like a glue stick.
No, it's not. They gotta wet it with blood and do this whole thing. So no, I don't think that Tyrion would have to be dead. Now I don't know that for a fact because there's so much about the Faceless Men we do not know.
Right,
but everything that I do know does not suggest that they can take a living person's face and just go walk around with it. That seems like it'd be OP.
Or even if he died in like Essos, how would they get his face, right? So there would have to be a lot of stuff to bring the Faceless Men to
Meereen and
Tyrion or vice versa.
And he's not on Arya's radar at all, right?
No,
like
not
where,
at all.
Where would that connection be? And Meereen and Braavos are
far away.
Mm-hmm. And I've even questioned whether, you know, we talked about this a little bit on the spoiler podcast, whether Arya is even going to get to kill all those names on her list, at least with the Faceless Man's blessing. And also, there's no way Martin's going to have her literally kill everyone on that list, because that would be dumb. Like, if she's got 12 names and she just crossed them all, like, that's
you're getting a lot of
that's
names.
Kill Bill.
If it were three names, I'd say sure, yeah she'll do it.
That's a lot, and there's already been people murdered that she wasn't responsible for, so.
Right.
And there's people on the list like the Hound who she might not want to cross off at this point.
Yeah, maybe.
If he's still alive. The whole Gravedigger theory thing.
I don't know. I like the Jaime idea. I mean, that seems totally possible.
Yeah.
To me. Like, the more they stretch that relationship and the more Cersei pushes him, because she's kind of been pushing him lately.
Yeah, but so here's the thing that blows my mind. And I'm wondering, because they keep on, I feel like this is something where they're trying to straddle the fence for some reason. It's not working for me. In the books, Cersei and Jaime are definitively on the outs.
Wow.
Like, Tyrion has planted in this idea to, one of the last things he tells Jaime is, you know, your sister has been fucking Lancel and the Kettlebacks and Moonboy, who is the court fool for all I know. And that's the way that's the last words he says to Jaime. And as Jaime goes forth in the rest of his POV, that's like echoing in his brain. Like,
okay,
Cersei's an awful person. I've kind of changed a little bit with this Brienne situation. I'm starting to make my face turn, and I'm realizing not only is she awful, but she's not even really faithful to me. Like, I'm not that special to her.
Right.
And at the end of when Cersei has to face her trial before Robert the Strong turns up, she sends a crow to Jaime that says, you know, Jaime, all is forgiven. I love you. I love you. I love you. Please come and save me. And Jaime crumples it up and like throws it in a fire.
Wow. Okay.
And
they're not there yet in the show.
Yeah. And I'm like, I kind of thought they were. There was a point where I felt like they were clearly on the outs and their relationship was mirroring nicely, not the same ways, but kind of tonally. Mm-hmm. And now they've kind of like thrown them back together. And I'm confused about why they would do that.
Right. And I'm not seeing the thing. I mean, maybe the situation with Dorne is going to be the thing that tears them apart, like, once and for all, but I don't know.
I mean, that's the thing. Like, it hasn't. That was all on the table this episode, and they're all swearing.
Right.
If anything, Cersei seemed like she was less into him than he was into her, because he's all trying to make her feel better, and she's just looking depressed, so.
Yeah.
Anyway, Luke B. He starts a new thought. There's no way, knowing what we know from Thoros, Beric, Lady Stoneheart, and the books, that Jon can come back right as rain. He's been dead for way too long. I'm not saying Jon can't come back as some kind of vengeant zombie corpse, but do we really think any of the people in that room, even Davos, would follow a Lady Stoneheart version of Jon Snow? I think my theory fits better. Mel is going to glamour Davos to look like Jon. This way, it appears he has risen from the dead in an almost Christ-like resurrection. In this way, Mel's vision of seeing Jon ride to Winterfell comes true. It also gets them out of that room, because I'm pretty sure the Night's Watch would turn on Alistair in a hot second if Jon Snow walked out of that room calling for his head.
Uh-huh.
Even if Ed comes back with the Wildlings, would Alistair really let them out? Having Davos appear to be a healthy Jon Snow solves this problem. It also buys him an episode or two.
Wow.
Can you, I mean, like, so he glamors, she glamors him to look like John just to, like, you know, fuck with the Black Brothers and get him to back off while they resurrect him for good. But that's the whole thing. It's like, yes, he's been dead too long, and if they bring him back, it's going to be more Lady Stoneheart, and it's going to be more Beric Dondarrion.
Mm-hmm.
But the whole theory of him warging into Ghost is he's essentially using Ghost like a refrigerator to preserve his consciousness. So even if he comes back as a, you know, zombified or white-looking corpse, he's going to have his full faculties, and he won't be kind of like a revenge-driven, insane person.
Okay.
And that's if you don't buy the theory that Lady Stoneheart is being animated by the Three-Eyed Crow, or that Jon Snow will be, you know, meat puppeted by Bran. Like, there's a lot of competing theories here.
So I got another one from I know you've talked about this necklace a little bit and the bracer that she gives to someone else. And,
yes,
to Mance, or to a guy who she makes look like Mance.
Yeah, brown shirt.
What, right, whatever.
Skeletor.
Is there any chance that she could snap this thing on? I got this from Twitter. Somebody tweeted this at me. Could she snap that thing onto John? Like, bring him back, snap it onto John, and then he's not dead too long? Now he's, like, somehow healed or glammed into regular John?
So he... His mind is preserving Ghost.
Uh-huh.
And his body gets resurrected, but he looks all fucked up.
Uh-huh.
So he gets his full consciousness back from Ghost, and she glamors him so he doesn't look like a fucking weirdo.
Right.
Which saves on the makeup and effects budget.
Yeah.
That's not a bad idea. That's not a bad idea at all.
That's kind of cool. Because I'm leaning more toward, like, this necklace is helping her glam, helping her stay looking young.
Sure, I agree. I think that's what we're being led to believe anyway.
Right. I mean, you know, we talked about potions. We talked about season 4 bathtub scene. I don't know what that says about it. But I don't know. I'm on that train.
That's a great. I think that's a good synthesis of the ideas because
right.
It would.
It seems like there are a lot of moving parts. Like people might roll their eyes and go, "Really? We needed all of this to get this job done."
Right. But I mean, don't sleep on the fact that like glamoring Jon Snow would save a lot. It'd save Kit Harington like 6 to 8 hours in a makeup chair a day.
It certainly would.
I mean, rather than be full-on white Jon Snow, that would be an interesting way to do it. And I don't understand from a book perspective why you'd do that.
Also, does the thing even fit on his neck? I mean, is that thing going to clasp?
Right.
Come on.
Right. Well, maybe he puts it on his wrist or something instead. Does it have to be on his neck? I mean, the whole Mance Rayder thing suggests that no. It
doesn't.
It's not the location. It's the jewel. But that's the other thing. It's like, I don't think the jewel itself does it. I think that it's the jewel is like a capacitor for whatever magic that she can spend time and effort imbuing that so she then doesn't have to concentrate and it can just kind of like...
Sure, I'd buy that.
It's like an energizer battery. Trevor D said, did Game of Thrones cut a scene in the first episode of season 6? I based this theory on a few points. The episode itself was shorter than the full 1 hour given, and previously on was much longer than we've seen in the past. I propose that the Double Ds wanted to begin season 6 just like season 5 with a flashback. A scene we've seen bits of in the trailer is a young Ned Snark at...
God, Ned Snark.
Young Ned Snark.
God, he's just so snark. Nobody likes to be around a snark.
Right. Of the House Sarcasm. Young Ned Stark at the Tower of Joy. Young Ned Stark actor Sebastian Croft's IMDb page a few months back stated that he was in season 6, episode 1. That has been changed, showing no mention of this episode. I contend the Double D's decided to back up the truck for the storyline. It's certainly a stretch, but it's worth mentioning. First of all, I know IMDb has been wrong about that stuff because, you know, number one, that stuff can be edited by anyone. And then it can be officially edited and all that stuff, but, like, especially months out, there's a lot of fan fuckery and you know, borderline hacking and stuff that goes on. And that's burnt us in the past in other shows. Secondly, I do feel like something big got cut. And maybe even at the last minute, because it does seem an awfully short runtime, and there was an unusual amount of missing connective tissue. But okay. Maybe it was a tower joint. Like, oh, we need to pull this out for later in the season. I don't know. But it does feel like there was a few missing parts.
Yeah, I think, you know, it makes a lot of sense to have that flashback scene in the episode where more information about that is revealed. There's some bigger reveal there, and that clearly wasn't in this episode, so maybe they realized that and said, this doesn't belong here, let's put it in episode 2 or 3 or whatever.
Yeah. Matt S. from New York City said, I was watching the season 6 trailer again and watched a clip of Tyrion appearing to go the way of Quentin Martell. If you'll recall, Jim, that's the prince of Doran that he sent to treat with Dany. He gets barbecued.
Yep.
Of course, I don't think that scene will be at the end, be the end of Tyrion. I just assumed it was sneaky editing, as you suggest. But what if it isn't just clever editing? We know that the Targaryens, or perhaps just Dany, are fireproof or not is a contentious topic. But what if all Targaryens are fireproof, or at least all special ones, like dragon riders or whatever? And what if Tyrion is about to suffer the fate of Quentin and get burnt to a crisp, but instead comes out of the flames unscathed, thus opening his eyes to the fact that he is, in fact, a Targaryen? Is that possible? Am I sitting here thinking I'm halfway brilliant, but really just reciting some previously discussed theory? Will we get Dinklage full frontal nudity when his clothes all burn?
Well,
he went
if you
there
want
on
that,
Saturday Night Live.
Right.
I mean,
go to Naked and Afraid spoof.
Yeah.
Isn't there a theory floating out there about Tyrion Targaryen?
Indeed, that he is a secret Targaryen as well. That he's the illegitimate son of the Mad King and Tywin's wife.
Okay.
And that... And there's a lot of evidence. I actually did a full-all blown-on podcast on this. If you go to the Spoiler Podcast archive that's in the show notes here, you can actually go and find the Secret Targaryen. I think it's called Secret Targaryen. Or maybe it's Dragon Rider theory. I can't remember exactly what it is, but I discussed evidence for him being a secret Targaryen. That'd be great. And none of that stuff is in the books, unfortunately, because a lot of that is internal monologue of like Tyrion when he was young, and you know, a lot of stuff that was told like third hand in the books that you kind of have to piece together. Having him just, like, if the show establishes that the Targaryens are fireproof, and I get it, like in the books, they're definitely not. That is the word of God. That is the word of Martin. If they emphasize that in the show, and that's a plot point, that's an easy shorthand to kind of... I don't think that's where Tyrion's like eyes open up, but I think that's the first thing that he might think, what the hell?
Okay.
Uh-huh. And, you know, that could be an easy way for the audience, because it does seem like a lot of show watchers assume that Targaryens are fire-resistant.
Sure.
Because they did a really good job of pushing that point in season one.
At the very least, it would have them thinking he's a Targaryen, because we don't know of anyone else who's ever resisted Dragon's fire. So,
exactly.
That's a reasonable place to lean if they show it that
again,
way.
And again, not consistent with the books, not consistent with Martin,
right.
But if it's a way to definitely streamline things.
And it would fulfill my Tyrion dragon riding prophecy, so
sure.
Let bring it on. I'm all for it.
Joe K. says, so here is a Jon Snow coming back theory co-developed with my lovely wife. We both believe Jon's parents are Rhaegar and Lyanna. Nothing new there.
Mm-hmm.
If we are correct about his parentage, that makes Jon a Targaryen, obviously. The question we found ourselves asking is, what happens to a dead body of someone who is truly dragon-blooded when subject to a funeral pyre after death? That's right. Two fireproof Targaryen emails in a row, people.
Jesus. Well.
Possible answer, the Targaryen yin, fire yin to the White Walker ice yang. What say you, good sirs, about the Song of Ice and Fire theory? Essentially...
What does he mean by the yin and yang there?
Well,
I mean,
so
I know the
Jon
the yin
is
and yang.
Already Starks are ice, Targaryen's fire.
Uh-huh.
You've got a Snow and a Stark being burnt on a pyre, so that's ice being subjected to fire, and that's going to be the thing that fully, you know, solidifies him as.
So will it res him? Is that what we're saying?
Yeah, that's an alternative thing. Like there's some kind of magical. I think we might have had a. You know, a half thought out theory on the last podcast is kind of suggests this too. But yeah, there's something magical that's going to happen in just that combination.
Okay.
But I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I do like the theory that Jon is both ice and fire.
Because, why would... I mean, if Targaryens are fireproof, it's certainly not some kind of biologic thing. It's got to be some kind of mystical thing. So, anyway.
Yeah, the more I think about R equals L plus J... Or whatever. Mm-hmm. Whatever it is.
No, you got it. Rhaegar plus Lyanna equals Jon Snow.
Oh, R plus L equals J. The more I think about it, the more just dead on right it sounds. Like, I can't imagine that that's not what the song, A Song of Ice and Fire is about, like, at its core.
That's what I'm saying. I'm 99.9% sure. In fact, depending on her running time, I might do... I saw a really awesome tinfoil theory that I think is batshit crazy...
Okay.
But it's super interesting. I might try to articulate it to you because I don't know it dead and I don't have a lot of notes for it, but I got the high points.
And maybe we save it.
Okay.
Maybe we save it for like a Jon Snow comes back.
It just came out like a couple days ago, so I like the idea of breaking tinfoil.
Ah.
But okay. Anyway, Doug L. says, so Melisandre reveals at the end of her episode that her appearance is a glamour. The show has never used glamour powers before, but in the books it's revealed that Mance Rayder is still alive and Melisandre used her powers to make it appear as if he was burned. Mance then went on to play a pivotal role in helping Theon and fake Arya escape the Winterfell. While the Winterfell aspect may be past, do you think the show went out of their way to show Melisandre's glamour power as a step one reveal towards explaining how Mance Rayder could return? So this is the theory.
How would that work at all?
They would have to not retcon, but they'd have to show some explanation for the man that we saw as Mance Rayder being burnt to death was not actually Mance Rayder, and he's still alive.
But that's I don't like that.
What I'm saying. Like, at a certain point, there's too many fucking people brought back to life.
Don't like it from a storytelling standpoint. Like, we're going to say that this thing you know you saw wasn't actually what you think you saw, and...
Yes. And also, the reason that was important is because he was sent on a mission to rescue what Jon thought was Arya. Okay. It turns out it was nobody. That's the thing. Like, you know, Sansa.
Oh, really? She finally accomplished her mission, huh? She became no one.
No, it's some girl, just random girl. Like, I think her name's Jean Poole. Like okay. One of Sansa's late girlfriends that was married off pretending to be Arya Stark. Well, Boltons were pretending just to give themselves some legitimacy. And most people that would have said, no, this is bullshit, I know what Arya Stark looks like, were dead at this point so they could get away with it.
Okay.
That's what I'm saying. Like, there's a significant amount of deviations, but it always feels like it's something a little bit more elegant. Like, instead of glaring this guy and doing all this stuff, just have Theon rescue, you know... Grab her hand and jump off the edge of the tower. Like,
all right.
But I don't know. So, like, do we want to make it more complicated? Do we want to continue using Occam's razor? I guess that's the question the Double D's probably ask themselves on a day-by-day basis.
I want to say they're setting something else up. It's not going to have to do with Mance and his glamming. It's going to have to do with...
Yeah.
Maybe Jon Snow, maybe something else with Melisandre entirely.
Yeah. Well, with Sir Alistair's guyliner, I don't know how much more glamming... we can afford. Zach OB said, just listen to the first spoiler podcast episode for the season where he mentioned Cold Hands as a white. However, I've always assumed he was one of the green men from the Isle of Faces.
What the fuck?
His appearance fits their description. He rides a big elk, which they are known to do. I'd say Bran's story will reveal the pact that the children of the forest had with the first men in the Isle of Faces. And this is the reason the children are working with the Green Men and Nita Stark, someone with the blood of the First Men brand.
You lost me.
Yeah, I did, and I don't care to explain this to you because I'm about to issue the following problems with this theory. Number one, it introduces yet another party, so that's a violation of Martin's razor.
Uh-huh.
Two, I don't know that I agree with you that this meets the description of Cold Hands, because as you say. The men of the Isle of Faces, they're said to have antlers grown out of their head. They do ride elks, yes, but they have like a dark green skin. Here's how Cold Hands is described in the book. I cribbed this from the wiki of Ice and Fire. Cold Hands is
a terrible masseuse, just a abysmal nurse.
Yeah, you don't want him anywhere near sensitive bits.
No.
Cold Hands is dressed in the mottled blacks and grays of the Night's Watch with a scarf that conceals his face. His hands are black and as cold as ice, and he rides a great elk. A flock of ravens flies under his command. He does not breathe. Summer mentions that he does not like the way... Well, I'm sorry, Summer doesn't mention. Summer is the direwolf of Rickon.
Okay.
Does not like the way Cold Hands... No, I'm sorry. Summer is the direwolf of Bran.
Mm-hmm.
Does not like the way Cold Hands smells. Dead meat, dry blood, a faint whiff of rot, and cold all over. Though Cold Hands is often described as dead but still alive, his eyes are black in contrast to the light blue of the whites and others. He's thin and gaunt, and his voice rattles. I feel like this guy is definitely white material. That does not sound like the Green Men.
I'll defer to you.
So, there you go. Now, like in the books, I don't know. Somewhat related but separate, the Crypts of Winterfell have always only had Stark kings. The tradition was broken by Ned when he put his sister down there. Now in Bran's Weirwood flashes, he sees some crazy sacrifices in front of the Heart Tree in Winterfell. I feel like there's some sort of secret that Stark kings passed down, but the secret was lost when Lord Rickard and Brandon, his heir, were both killed by the Mad King. thus leaving Ned alone to pick up the pieces, not even knowing about the pact he is supposed to keep. He might be to blame for the White Walkers. Maybe the Starks were supposed to give sacrifices, much like Craster has. All right, so let me unpack this for you. Lord Rickon, Rickard, rather, was Ned's father.
Okay.
And he was the Warden of the North, and he was the ruler of Winterfell. His son, Brandon, was the older son of Ned. And he's speculating that, like, what if there is this long family secret that's handed down generation after generation, the same way that this phrase, a Stark must always be in Winterfell, is significant to the books?
Uh-huh.
The fact that, like, maybe, and Bran sees these hideous human sacrifices where they're spraying blood on the trees and hanging intestines from the branches. What if the Starks are supposed to, and this is a dirty little secret they keep, do some kind of human sacrifice to appease the White Walkers? Because both the king and the heir, the lord and the heir, were both wiped out at once. Those are the only two guys that have the secret. Yeah. And then Ned didn't know what to do. And he lets women into the boys only club, and now all hell breaks loose.
Oh, man. Yeah. That could be it. Or it could be, when did all the Starks leave Winterfell? It was a while ago. I don't know how it lines up with the winter coming.
Right.
But right now we know there's no Starks in Winterfell.
Well, that's the thing. And I don't think that can trigger the White Walkers because it seemed like they were on the move before. But yeah. I've always suspected that one of the plot points is going to be the White Walkers. They're not evil and they're not necessarily assholes. But they're there because the men were supposed to be doing something and it's part of a long bargain between them that they have stopped doing.
Yeah.
And it's an easy, you know, with the human sacrifice we know the Northmen used to do, and with Craster keeping himself in their good graces by doing the human sacrifice, that's an easy connection to make.
I think so.
It's a hazy one, because right. You can't just draw a line right from point A to point B.
And
but
it assumes, you know, that information was lost somewhere. And
yes, and it assumes Book 6 will do something to make all this make sense. But there is definitely, you can see where, okay, there's not a bridge over the river built yet, but I see the pylons that might connect.
Right.
So yeah, I like that. I like that a lot.
We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if Very Special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
Let's move on to Rich E. No word whether he is in fact rich. One interesting thing to me that I didn't hear you mention regarding the wall, Alistair Thorne gives what I thought a great speech about how Jon Snow let the rapists, murderers, and thieves south of the wall. Well, what he's not saying is that 90% of the Black Brothers are in fact rapists, murderers, and thieves who took the Black to avoid rotting in a dungeon.
Yep.
It really only shows the difference between the Watch and the Wildlings is that where they were born. John clearly has the right of it. They're all in the same and need to unite against the others.
Good point.
I like that a lot. In fact, I probably should have saved that for the main cast next week. But the next part is spoilerific. It's so why that's why I got landed in the spoiler part. One thing from the episode I didn't like as a book reader was Dorne. And no, I'm not asking for the Dark Star, and I hate the Quinthan plotline. But in the books, Prince Dorne has a plan. He wants revenge on the Lannisters, but is playing the long game. He doesn't join with Renly or Stannis or Robb because he has his own plan to not only get revenge, but to make his daughter queen. He's smart and patient and seems to be a formidable adversary. On the show, he's nothing but the weak man Alaria sees. He won't go to war, and he has no plan to get revenge. He's letting the Lannisters off the hook because he is afraid of them. He's a weak ruler with no idea what is going on around him. He has an intimidating guard who is killed instantly. The rest of the guards betrayed Dorne, and he is killed without resistance. I thought it was more interesting in the books that the Myrcella plot was to crown her as queen rather than to kill her. Alaria and the snakes killing a teenage girl and their own cousin makes them completely unlikable as characters. Naming Myrcella queen, however, would create the war they want and is a much smarter idea as you can hope to win allies as well. As a book reader, what really worries me about this show only plot is that it seems less thought out than the rest of the stories. The intricacies are all lacking. The characters seem much more one-dimensional. Dorne is weak. Alaria and the snakes are ruthless, but have no forethought. This is the elaboration I mentioned earlier on in the podcast of like why a lot of book readers don't like what's going on in Dorne and why it feels superfluous. It's like, if you're going to not do Dorne right, why do him at all?
Yeah.
And that's where I'm like, I honestly don't know except for something about the Sand Snakes and their activities must be pivotal enough. And the fact that you have to get some kind of closure with Oberon since the fans, you know, that would be like Ned getting killed and you never find out what Robb did about it.
Right.
Yeah, maybe he got mad. Maybe he called a host. Maybe he got murdered by his, you know, in a marriage alliance. Who really knows? Like, you would have that kind of situation. He was such a fan favorite, and rightfully so.
Yeah.
But yeah, those are all good points. Anything you want to add?
No.
Cruising on to Dana J, two small things to suggest. Have you considered that John has already warged into Ghost?
Sure.
I didn't talk about this on the podcast, but is there any evidence? Like, to me, I was looking for it, but Ghost seemed like baseline loyal direwolf concerned about something going on with his master.
Yeah.
I don't like being locked up, and I can tell that there's some shit going on out there, and I can maybe smell John and death, and I don't like it. But you, I guess, and also, like, I don't like it when Sir Alistair knocks on my door. Those are all things I think Ghost could do without John being inside him, but they're also consistent with John's consciousness being inside him.
Absolutely, yeah. Trying to bring attention to the fact that John's body is out in the courtyard.
Especially since John is not going to be as good as his brother at warging, since this is like a surprise to him at this point. He's like, oh shit, I'm in a wolf. he could think he's dreaming like Bran initially did. He was having these long dreams, and it's really hard to say. But certainly there's nothing inconsistent with John being in there. I can't think of what would be inconsistent.
Right. And in the books, isn't his last word
ghost?
Ghost. Yes. So that's kind of the place I'm operating from now, having found that out.
Why do you think that they changed that? Do you think that had been too obvious if his last words were ghost?
Because
it kind of borderline is in the books, too.
I think so, yeah.
Okay. Especially with all the warging and shit that's going on in the books.
Right.
Daniel also has a new theory. The stone statues on Dragonstone, you're aware of the fact that Dragonstone actually has stone statues of dragons.
Where is Dragonstone?
That's Valeria? It's a little island that's just a little bit off the shore from King's Landing, and that was the ancestral seat of the Targaryens. But ever since Robert Baratheon took over, that's kind of where he... Actually, I think this is a tradition that heir apparent to the throne would live in Dragonstone, and then the king would actually live in King's Landing.
Is that... That's not that burnt-out husk of a town where Tywin and
Arya are. So here's the thing to remember. It has a big wooden table that's shaped like Westeros.
Okay.
Where I think Stannis fucked Melisandre on it. But it's not super important, except for the fact that even in the show, it has stone dragons. You can see them whenever it has its little mechanical pop-up.
Okay.
Or no, did it ever have a mechanical? I thought it did. But I know we see some establishing shots. So you can see some big stone dragons.
Hmm.
He thinks they'll be transformed into real dragons at some point in the story. I first suspected this in a chapter of the book where Davos was walking across a bridge on Dragonstone at night and thought to himself that the way to fight light shadows were playing with the statues. Wait, the way the firelight shadows were playing with the statues, they almost looked alive. Later, I remember Dany's prophecy in the House of the Undying about a great stone beast taking flight. Then, in A Song of Ice and Fire, World book came out and talked about Dragonstone being forged with a bunch of magic. Yeah, there's actually a lot more. I did consider this in one of my Tinfoil Theory podcasts. I think it might be the Dany Prophecy one, which was a long one. But yeah, I don't want to burst your bubble, but this is a pretty widely, not accepted, but this is a widely bandied about theory.
Yeah.
That waking the, you know, and there's a lot of talk about waking of dragons, both metaphorically and real.
Right, and like the idea of stone men, I think, is also part of that. Like people who aren't actually dead but are called stone men, and
yes,
they move around, and like,
yes,
that idea is kind of out there.
It's putting that like stone can be a metaphor.
Yeah,
that, you know,
but or it's something, you know, that stone can be alive. Yeah,
yeah. That wouldn't surprise me. And also, I've often wondered if Euron's dragon horn doesn't control dragons, but it actually is the key to unlocking the stuff. Like, if you blow that on Dragonhorn, then boom, you got dragons.
Uh-huh.
They're, like, frozen in carbonite.
Gargoyle style.
Yeah. There you go. There you go. Bringing it back to gargoyles. I like it. Frankie R. said, I've been thinking about the theory of the 1000th Lord Commander having some kind of poetic meaning in the series that you mentioned in the last podcast. I keep coming back to the theme of cycles in Game of Thrones. Martin obviously loves the idea of inevitability, destiny, prophecy, and cycles. The idea has been tossed about that, much like seasons, the White Walkers are just a cyclical occurrence. This, then, could also be true of the Night's Watch. In my mind, the 1000th Lord Commander would be the seasonal reset of the Night's Watch. The hordes are pushed back, peace is restored to man, and the Night's Watch reinitiates at the 1000th generation watch against the night. That's poetic, right?
I suppose so.
And that's, I guess that's, that ties into someone else's theory from last week, too, that the Night's Watch might be disbanded and something else formed anew.
Uh-huh.
And maybe that the Wildlings will be the backbone of that.
Yeah.
I think that's kind of a cool idea. It might not be something prophetic or mysterious. It's just a renewal type of thing.
Right. I mean, the Night's Watch is, you know, it's like a vehicle from the 40s that's been sitting in someone's garage for 80 years, right? It's like, that kind of is just
rubber's
run
all
down.
Dry rot
and right. I mean, now we're accepting rapists and thieves,
sure,
and that's pretty much all of them. And,
yeah,
you know, the fucking White Walkers haven't been around for 1,000 years or whatever.
Yeah.
So we're just going to throw the worst of the worst up there and hope for the best.
Yep.
So it could be time to stir that pot a little.
Jason Sione from the Nattercast, which I recommend if you like quality podcasts on television, check them out. The thing that's cool about them is they have some background in actually filmmaking that they bring to their podcast. They got a short take. Episode 3, it's called Oathbreaker. It's rumored to feature the Tower of Joy. Ned, R plus L equals J, discuss.
Okay.
So
yeah, all of it.
my first thought is Oathbreaker. I don't jump to the Tower of Joy and Ned. I jump to Brienne's sword.
Right.
Oathkeeper.
Uh-huh.
And from the lay of the land in this episode, I mentioned in a preview podcast that I thought Sansa might fulfill the Lady Stoneheart part, that she's going to be pissed at Brienne for missing her, you know, post and for betraying her, and she's going to give her the mission that, like, well, and you're showing up with this Lannister sword, and none of that happened. Everything is, like, very touching and moving, and, like, Sansa's just relieved to have someone looking after her, and Brienne is can't believe that she's finally going to get to be the knight that she set out to be and fulfill her oaths.
Yeah.
What the fuck is going to happen to have an episode called Oathbreaker?
You get Brienne and Jaime in another whirlpool, and I don't know what's going to happen. I mean, shit, all bets are off.
All kinds of oaths are broken.
Right.
Here's this.
The old gods and the new. It doesn't matter.
If I get out the box and I try to think about this, Ned made a promise to his sister. And we don't know exactly the nature of that promise, just that he promised her something important that came at a great personal cost. I mean, most of us think that that's the fact that Jon is secretly a Targaryen.
Yeah.
And he's being hidden until the time is right, whatever that time is. But I wonder if he ever did break that vow, and he actually did tell a secret to someone besides Howland Reed. And I wonder if this is going to be a way to show that, that the Oathbreaker will be Ned going, you know, not keeping the exact letter of his promise to his sister, and that that will be part of the flashback, and that that person will be significant. Because, you know, we've always wondered, okay, well, Howland Reed probably knows the secret. Where the hell is he?
Sure.
I don't know. Maybe it'd be a way to introduce his character or another character that also would have value of knowing that, or might.
Right, but we don't even need that, right? What if Howland Reed comes back?
Yeah, but you'd have to introduce the Tower of Joy. You'd have to show that he was... Yeah, I guess that would be
so it. Episode 2, introduce the Tower of Joy and that whole secret. Episode 3, Howland Reed comes back.
So what's the... So then what the Oathbreaker? That's the thing I keep... What is the
Doesn't he have an oath as well?
Or, I don't think so.
No, he's not under the same Ned oath?
Well, I mean, him and Ned are best buddies, right? So,
right.
Like, I think it's a bro code violation.
Okay, but not
also,
a...
Yeah, I mean, I don't know why Howland would, like... tell people that either, because he's a secretive man by nature. Like, even amongst northern lords, no one really knows him.
Yeah. It could also be as simple as Brienne has to make a tough choice when it comes to Sansa, right? Like,
but what's the tough choice that would cause her being an Oathbreaker?
I don't know, but I agree with you. My mind immediately goes to her sword.
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
Is that so? Is it still because Sansa? It's in her character to be kind of impetuous and then make foolish decisions.
Okay.
Is it possible that she finds out that this is the Lannister sword and then suddenly becomes suspicious of Sansa, or I'm sorry,
of Brienne,
and wants to, like, hey, me and Theon are going to take our chances with the, you know, Night's Watch. You get the fuck out of here. Or if you want to prove your loyalty, the service I ask you is to kill Jaime Lannister.
Right, or maybe it's something dishonorable, like that she finds dishonorable, but Sansa doesn't, and she commands her to do it, and Sansa broke her oath.
It'd be interesting because that would be interesting too, because Jaime told her to take this and fulfill her oath to Catelyn Stark, which was to find, protect, and serve her daughters.
Right.
So there's nothing in that that says that she can't kill Jaime if that's what, like, her liege lordess or mistress asked of her.
Sure.
But it could be that Brienne's like, no, I won't do that. And then she's an Oathbreaker.
Yeah.
Interesting. I don't know.
It's all up in the air. I mean, any of those things could come to pass.
And I could see, like, unfortunately, I think that a lot of people would dislike Sansa, because she's, instead of listening and getting the full facts. But she already knows that she's got the Lannister sword, because that's what, you know, that's what Littlefinger pointed out to her last season at the inn, which kind of harshed the whole thing anyway.
Right.
So
she doesn't care about that at this point.
Or she does, but she's swept up in emotion. Nah, she accepted her into her service. That's not something you do. I guess it's something you can do. She is still a teenage girl.
Right. She was pretty cold at the time, too. Maybe not thinking well.
It's hard for me to see from episode one how they get to where Brienne is just on the outs with Sansa.
Mm-hmm.
But it's got to happen some way. Is that going to be a Lady Stoneheart episode?
Does it have to happen? I mean... Because you're saying if Lady Stoneheart is actually Sansa, right?
Uh-huh. Or no, I'm saying, like, maybe they've gone, like, I think it's been established that Double D's are not going to do Lady Stoneheart, but they could.
Really?
Yeah.
Shit. That sounds amazing.
You just like the zombies, man.
Yeah, well.
But it could be a way to get that in there, and then maybe Kat is the one that comes back and says you're an Oathbreaker. Although she founded, that's this remix thing. I don't know.
Right.
I'm going crazy here. Go crazy up at the lake.
I have some stuff about Brienne and Sansa to talk about.
Shoot.
I don't know if we have feedback on this, but we talked about the Quiet Isle stuff, right? Where the theory of the Hound, is he still alive? And Brienne goes up there and kind of sees a monk who may or may not be the Hound.
The Gravedigger theory.
Right.
Sure.
So she apparently, what you told me before the podcast, she goes there, she goes to the Quiet Isle because she's looking for Sansa and Arya, right?
Yes.
So now that she's found Sansa and Arya, is there any reason for her to even go to the Quiet Isle at all? And does this lend some credence to the idea that if we don't go there in the show, that the Hound is dead?
Well, certainly if we don't go to the Quiet Isle this season, I would think that the Gravedigger theory is... I mean, the Gravedigger theory I don't think is falsifiable. Because if we never hear from the Hound again, you could just say, well, that's a really nice coda for a very tortured character.
Sure.
And it's, like, not obvious. It's kind of a wink at the audience. So I wouldn't disprove it, but I'd say no. We're not going to get the Gravedigger theory to come true. He's not there. The you know, Clegane Bowl is definitely not happening.
Okay.
Get unhyped. But that's a really good question. How in the world? I mean, it seems inevitable that Brienne and Sansa have to split up, because how in the hell could Brienne get back to the Vale? Like, if they bumped into Littlefinger and Littlefinger does some kind of Jedi mind trick on him and says, oh, you got to get back to the Vale, that's where you'll be safe, and uh-huh. Brienne can escort you there.
Okay.
That would be kind of interesting, I suppose.
Although, yeah, I don't know.
And or maybe someone else. Like, someone else go to the Quiet Isle to see the Gravedigger. Because it's not essential that,
right.
That Brienne was only over there because she was searching for Sansa and Arya. She's found them now.
Yeah, so we know that won't happen exactly as it did in the books, but
yeah,
it may happen in some other way still.
Yeah. I wonder if it'll be just something as dumb, not dumb, but like efficient, I should say. As, you know, there's a trial with Cersei, she calls Robert the Strong, the High Sparrow freaks out, and he's heard of, like, you know, the High Sparrow would probably know that the Hound is hiding out on their island.
He could.
And he sends an envoy to be like, maybe it's even that Lancel guy with the star cut on his head. Like, hey, go get the Hound out of storage.
Uh-huh.
I don't know. I honestly don't know, because it does seem, for that all the work, you got to split Brienne from Sansa, and you got to give Brienne a legitimate reason to go back to the Vale. And
maybe that's Oathbreaker. Maybe she leaves Sansa's side for some reason, and
I don't know.
That's the start of that arc, too.
I don't know, man. I don't know. Let's see. Paul McF from Coventry, England. I'm a new listener. I've gone back and listened to all of last season's podcast. There was something you mentioned in the 508 spoiler edition about Jorah Mormont receiving Longclaw from Jon at some point, thus reclaiming his birthright as such. Could it be possible that Jon Snow is gifted Dark Sister, one of the lost House Targaryen blades from Brendan Bloodraven Rivers, who is supposed to be the last known owner? You know him better as the Three-Eyed Crow, Jim.
Okay.
Maybe in some kind of Harry Potter-style fox/raven dropping it to him in his time of need. I don't know if this necessarily fits into the latest episode, but surely it will soon. Oh, boy.
Oh, man, I just got a lot of ideas. They're all probably terrible. But
so here's my idea first. You mentioned that he's got Dark Sister, and it's true that he's the last known possessor of that famous sword. But there's also the most famous is Blackfyre. That's like the Targaryen blade. That's the one that Aegon the Conqueror brought over and whipped all of Westeros' ass with.
Okay.
And it would be interesting with his weirwood net if he is able to find out the location of that blade, and somehow he's got both of them, and he gives one to Danny and one to John. Like, that's your inner, like, oh, Danny and John forever and ever, they're going to kick everyone's butt and be the ultimate heroes, and they've got the original conquering blades, and you know, that's like super fanboy hype or fangirl hype. What is your theory? What's your idea?
I might save him to next week. I might save him to the non-spoiler section, because it is all speculation on stuff that we know from the show. So,
because I don't know that there's anything that they've suggested that there's anything magical about any of these Valyrian steel blades. They're just really, really, really good swords. And also,
well, we know now that there probably is for fighting the White Walkers.
What I mean,
right?
Is, like, there's nothing, like, they don't have special powers. Like, it doesn't grant you +4 agility.
Okay.
It does kill White Walkers and whites. It does. It works like a champ.
Okay.
It's as good as obsidian, only it's reusable. But I don't think there's anything that suggests that, like, Blackfyre or Blackfyre or Dark Sister is especially powerful amongst them.
Okay.
You know? But no, I do like that theory. I don't know how it would be. I don't know how it would work out and why John would, like, I guess, upgrade. But it is interesting. I guess Bran needs a Valyrian steel sword. That'd be cool.
Okay.
Or shit, Mira could, since they're up there in the middle of White Walker country. Ryan P., just something came to my head regarding both Bran and Jojen. Jojen is the brother of Mira, who died last season to grievous fire... No, season before, to grievous gut stabbings and fireball wounds.
Mm-hmm.
What if whatever happened at the Tower of Joy influenced the Stark children and Reed family to be able to warg? Ned refuses to speak of what happens at Tower of Joy, and Hal and Reed disappears in the books, yet only the Stark children and Reed children have this ability in the show. Is this mere coincidence? Ryan here is suggesting that there's some kind of maybe supernatural event or perhaps ritual that happened that went down here that kickstarted these wargings. I think that the show has suggested that it's not just the Stark children. This is magic in general returning to the world. No one understands why, and no one understands why it's happening, but it's a fact that magical things are returning to the Earth and getting stronger. So yeah. That's the problem I have with the theory. It's Occam's razor suggests that the simpler solution is the one that the show presents, which is magic is returning. You're adding an extra part to it. But, you know, if Ned and Howland Reed, like, slit the Kingsguard from balls to neck and wear their innards around their thing and chant a whole bunch of oogie boogie, then I will be happy to be wrong. I don't know if I'll be happy to be wrong. That sounds freaky. But maybe, I will definitely admit it.
Maybe Howland Reed is the tree guy. Maybe he warged into a tree.
Happened. That's the ultimate Occam's razor. Howland Reed is actually just a guy in the tree.
Nobody can find no Howland Reed because he's not here anymore.
Brendan Rivers, he didn't read any of the egg and dunk shit. No one cares about that stuff anyway. Like, I get it. It's like, look. Okay. This is a book podcast, so I got to be careful.
Yeah.
No one doesn't care. But I'm saying, if you're a show watcher, you have no idea who the hell the three-eyed crow is other than some old dude in a tree.
Right.
It would be kind of cool if they could somehow explain that that's what Howland Reed did after.
He's warged into that thing.
But he's not old enough to have the kind of knowledge that the Blood Raven would have, I guess. He doesn't know, like, all the secret history of the Targaryens and stuff that... I mean, that's the nice thing about the Three-Eyed Raven as Blood Raven is that he knows a lot about a lot. Because he's been around, he's been a Lord Commander of the Night's Watch, he's been the Hand of the King, he's a fucking borderline warlock, in a time where that was kind of, you know, super rare. How do they pin all that in the Howland Reed? I don't know.
That was the most tinfoil of theories.
Hey, I like it.
Okay.
Olivia D. said, I really dislike the Dorne plot, and she's going to elaborate why. This is yet another anti-Dorne. I think this is the last one, too. Last season when casting was announced for Dorne, I realized a Martin's razor would be applied since we lost 2/3 of Dorne's children, Quentin and Arianne. While I wasn't a big fan of Arianne's chapters in A Feast for Crow and Dance for Dragons, the overall arc of the Sand Snakes and Arianne teaming up to crown Myrcella and start a war over Oberyn's death made total sense to me. These were young, impatient women who are hot-blooded and wanting revenge for something they've only heard about secondhand. Arianne did not know her father's plans and suspected he was going to give her birthright to her younger brother. I absolutely loved Ilaria in the books. She was broken about losing her lover, Oberyn, but was willing to listen to Doran and protect her family. When Doran sent Aerio to bust up the Sand Snake's plans and have them locked up in the tower at Sunspear to prevent war, Ilaria agreed with his decision. And she includes this quote from Ilaria. She says, Oberyn wanted vengeance for Aelia. Now the three of you want vengeance for him. I have 4 daughters, I remind you, your sisters. My Aelia is 14, almost a woman. Obella is 12, at the brink of maidenhood. If you should die, must El and Obella seek vengeance for you, and then Doria and Lori for them? If that is how it goes, round and round forever, I ask again, where does it end? I saw your father die. Here is his killer. And at this point, she's holding in her hands Gregor Clegane's skull. Okay. Because that was one of the terms for peace, that they have to cut off his head and send it to them as proof that the murderer of their children and the princess was at least brought vengeance upon. Note, this does not happen in the show.
Right.
But that's the cool possibility is in the books, Gregor Clegane, that has no head.
Yeah.
And there's
is why the Joffrey speculation and all that.
Yeah. And also there's some really cool stuff that Bran sees in a vision of, like, you know, this giant armored figure and his visor lifts up and just like a the Shining style curtain of blood erupts from it, you know.
And he says, I'm the Juggernaut, bitch.
Anyway, she's referring to Gregor's skull. She says, can I take a skull to bed with me to give me comfort in the night? Will it make me laugh or write me songs or care for me when I'm old and sick? Olivia continues, so instead of this insightful, strong woman from the books, we're given a short-sighted, vengeful woman who murders an innocent child, Oberyn's remaining family, his brother and nephew. Ilaria was there when Oberyn claimed Dorne does not hurt little girls, and she was there when Oberyn died after volunteering to be Tyrion's champion. The Double D's took a strong female character and completely changed that. Since Quentin meets a crispy end via Dragonfire, and the show is cutting out the Fagon plot, which makes me happy as I'm not a supporter of the fake dragon, I understand the need to alter this plot. Cutting Arianne out of the show, I always assumed that they would place the majority of her scheming on the Sand Snakes, which they have done, but what really made the Dorne plot for me entertaining is figuring out what Dorne was planning. From Arianne's point of view chapters, it seems like all he was doing is watching his kids play in the gardens while suffering from his gout. Then he mic drops everyone when he reveals he had been planning revenge with Oberyn for decades to rob the Lannisters of everything they held dear and restore the Targaryens to power. He had secretly arranged for Arianne to marry Viserys so she would be the queen of the Seven Kingdoms. This is a little dry pie. We've already talked about this.
Right.
But she says, Dorne's book plan demonstrated he was a cunning man who realized vengeance was a dish best served cold. Instead of getting this great moment for Dorne, we get Ellaria murdering the remaining members of House Martell. I guess we are supposed to assume Dorne will support being ruled by a group of bastard women and no major house with Dorne, and Dorne will want to rule. I mean, that's the big problem. Who's taking over? The fact that Dorne, not that it was super interesting or relevant to the plot, but it's made much less so.
Yeah.
The characters are more one-dimensional. They don't have any... Dorne is an ineffectual ruler that is not loved by his people and is assassinated with no resistance.
And not a lot of supporting evidence on screen. Yeah, even as a show watcher, I'm feeling the effects of the kind of skimping on this plot line. Even though I don't know what it could have been. I just know that it should have been better.
You get a Reddit meltdown thread.
Yeah.
Because these people that do know that, like, okay, Dorne looks like this, but he does have... Everyone's got their little kind of crowning moment of badass. And they robbed him from that, and why?
Yeah.
And again, it's like, you can't have all these daughters and all these vengeance plans and these wheels within wheels. Like, there's only so many hours in television. You got to simplify it. But I am puzzled about the choices they've made thus far. And that's the spoiler podcast. Again, this is very much, if you want to send us feedback, by the way, as always, GameOfThrones@BaldMove.com, forums.baldmove.com. If you want to discuss the if you want to discuss the episodes, there's both a spoiler and non-spoiler thread, so stay in your lane. But again, this is going to be a work in progress, because it might be a solution that we implement if this is tedious to people, this kind of like, you know, going back and explaining stuff, is maybe that I do need to sit down with Jim for a bit before the podcast, and we kind of need to rehearse this. That's not our normal workflow, but that's something we could do if we think that that's a, you know, if that's a solution, if people are finding us tedious.
Well,
I
mean, honestly, my opinion is, if that's the case, maybe you should just continue to do the podcast on your own, because if it's not going to be back and forth and questions asked and answered, then there's no point in me being on it at all, because I don't have the knowledge that you have, and if I'm not going to be able to ask those questions, what am I here for, you know?
So I respect that. But I will say that, like, I think that even in this podcast, it's 75% that back and forth and, like, 25% me explaining things to you that the other book readers already know. So, like, if we could just iron out the 25% where I give you, like, a 15-20 minute primer, hey, here is the, like, fake, like, you know, I just didn't explain the fake dragon theory to you because that's a whole other thing. I could sit down and say, hey, here's how this is. We could get it up on the whiteboard and figure all that stuff out so you would know what you need to. So, you know, you can still have those reactions and you can bring those into the podcast, but the actual explaining is out. But then again, I don't know how many show watchers who are dipping their toe in the water that might find this valuable. And also, I don't know how annoying it is to sit through a theory that's being explained to you again.
Sure.
I do know, like, that's the sobering thing. There are 4 times the number of listeners on this season than there were when I first did the spoiler podcast, and I doubt that everyone's gone back and listened to all those old ones. So how much review is this really?
Sure.
You know, because, like, yeah, if you're read up on all your Song of Ice and Fire stuff, then all this stuff is review and you're just discussing with people. So I don't know. I mean, this is going to be, we're leaning on you guys and gals for feedback. Again, GameOfThrones@BaldMove.com if you'd like to send us in that or get on the forums. Because, yeah, ultimately, this is always kind of being an evolution. Like, I've always worked on it. I didn't really know what I was doing when I first did it. I got reasonably good at it. I will say that this is so much easier, having second person in this room. It took so much. I mean, scripting stuff out just takes a lot longer than just having the topic and knowing that I can have a good conversation with this guy.
Right.
But I'm willing to do it. It's just, I don't know what people prefer. So okay. It's an experiment. We're trying it out this season, and love to hear what you think about it, and excited to see what happens next week. It does seem, I mean, that's the big thing is I'm excited in this season in a completely different way. Previous seasons, I'm like, oh man, it's going to be so cool when I finally get, and there's two outcomes. Either they do it exactly like I think, or they deviate, and then I decide whether it's as good or not as good, and usually it's not as good. But this season, I'm excited to be like, well, you know, what are we going to learn? I mean, how is they're going to solve right. these knots with Brienne, and what does the Dorne, where are the Sand Snakes going? Like, we're really, we're going to get to spoil the books, which is exciting.
Right.
Like, I want to know what the hell's going on in the story more than anything, and these are important clues. They're the only new clues we're going to get until George gets the book out, you know? That's exciting. Even if you don't agree with right. it, I like coming out an open mind and using it as just like, okay, this maybe is a telephone game version of what's happening in Game of Thrones, but it still tells us some things are going to happen in the books, right?
Absolutely. I would think so. Yeah.
So,
I mean, the phrase "here be dragons" has never been more relevant
sure.
than it is right now.
We're off the map.
Completely.
There's the dragons. I guess that's the viewpoint I have on it, and I'm not going to get too worked up on it because there will be a reckoning when the book is released. I imagine I'll probably podcast about it. There's going to mm-hmm. be a reckoning about where did the books go? Where did the show go? Can we judge this in a new light? Is it better? Is it worse? But it seems putting the cart before the horse to just be like, this is terrible. There's no way this is going to happen. Dorne isn't you know, all that stuff.
I don't know. I feel like there's some just fundamental storytelling mistakes here.
Yeah, but again, how many of those are self-inflicted and how many of those are, well, the beginning of Dorne was awesome and the end of Dorne is awesome. The middle of Dorne is really just goes nowhere.
Yeah,
and
so
it's super
it.
Complicated and there's POV chapter after POV chapter that just gets undone with a single speech. And
yeah.
then that speech, you think it's awesome, and then the guy gets burned alive by dragons and... Like, that's a lot of wah, wah.
True.
So that's what I'm saying about a reckoning. Like,
yeah.
it could be that after sober analysis, this is the best they could have done with the material they had to work with. And again, you know, there's people out there that love the adaptations that Peter Jackson did of The Hobbit.
Oh,
I think those
God.
Are bloated beyond all recognition and destroy the things that worked about the original Hobbit. And there's other people to say it could have been 3 hours longer. If you're that kind of fan, I can imagine this Game of Thrones is a lot to swallow.
Yeah.
But if you're like me and you're like, you know, I appreciate the visuals and the spectacle, but my God, this was not the Hobbit I grew up with. And I would have liked to seen a little bit more of an editorial hand in that and maybe knock it down to one movie or most two. Maybe we can see that the Double D's knew what they were doing and were trying their best all along. But, you know, that could be years away.
Sure.
So, can't wait to hear what you guys think. And we'll be back next week. We'll be back this Sunday with the Instant Cast, Tuesday with the Main Cast, and again next Friday with the Spoiler Cast. Until then, I'm Aaron.
I'm Jim.
Have
see
a
ya.
Great weekend.